This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. The global COVID-19 pandemic has affected clinical research in many universities and research centres worldwide. So how are research institutions coping with this disruption and how will they be able to stay on track in terms of targets and funding? I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang, Chief Scientific Officer of Cancer Research Malaysia, to find out more about how cancer research specifically has been affected and how they plan to keep their eye on the ball. How are you, Professor Teo?
I'm very good. Thank you, Xiaoyik.
Thanks for speaking to us. You know, this year, 2020, was the start of a new decade and had, you know, in many areas, it was full of promise and anticipation in what we wanted to achieve. What had you been looking forward to in terms of cancer research?
Well, I've been hugely excited with the new decade because for the first time, we are being able to harness the immune system in order to be able to fight cancers more effectively. And this isn't just one way of harnessing the immune system. Three or four different approaches have been tried, and I was looking forward to being able to offer more immunotherapy for different patients in order to be able to improve their outcome. The second area that I've been really looking forward to has really been on precision medicine. So in the past, we used to treat cancers according to where they occur. So if you get breast cancer, you get one treatment. You get colon cancer, you get a different type of treatment and so on. But now we are able to now break down even breast cancer and understand what are the genes that drive each individual type of breast cancer. So that basically means that 10 different breast cancers, for example, could receive different types of treatment based on the genomics of that cancer. And more with the advances in genomics and our own contribution to understanding genomics in Asian patients, I've been looking forward to really figuring out how we might be able to implement precision medicine to improve the outcome for cancer patients right here in Malaysia. But the third area that I've also been working on within Cancer Research Malaysia is how do we address the gap in cancer care through approaches that can help low-income patients. So we know that the gap between high-income and low-income patients in terms of outcome is increasing. That means high-income patients have a greater chance of surviving cancer. And we've been working on initiatives to try and bridge that gap, and there were already some successes, and I was looking forward to being able to continue those efforts and bridge that gap.
So then in light of the pandemic and various lockdown measures, including here in Malaysia, how has cancer research been affected? Maybe we could take a big picture and look at what's happening worldwide first, very briefly.
I think the main thing would be that in hospitals, many hospitals have had to divert their services to the very acute situation of dealing with COVID-19. That basically means that a lot of the other research is considered periphery or in a sense in the scope of essential and non-essential. So that basically means that clinical trials, for example, the recruitment has dropped. In the US, recruitment for clinical trials where data is available has dropped by already half, and in other places it's not yet reported because everyone's so busy firefighting with the COVID-19 situation. So this affects research long term because not only funding and manpower has been diverted to COVID-related research. I think this is absolutely critical because we're in such highly unusual circumstances at the moment. We need to be able to throw all of our resources into dealing with COVID-19. But eventually, we need to figure out when do we return to normal? When do we start to deal with the diseases that are killing a lot of people, including non-communicable diseases like cancer, heart disease, metabolic disease, and so on. So at some point, we need to transition back from this acute situation to also dealing with chronic diseases.
And let's talk specifically about Cancer Research Malaysia's work. How have you been affected by the movement control order?
Well, we have three parts of our work. The first part is the laboratory-based research. And in the main, the laboratory research has ground to a halt, simply because our scientists are not allowed to access the laboratories. And that basically means that we are currently working on a lot of background preparations and reports and so on, but it's suboptimal because we can't really go back to the lab to do experiments. The second part of our work is more on data. So our scientists deal with a lot of big data. So for example, we're hosting the largest genomic map of Asian breast cancers. We have created the largest genetic mapping of 16,000 women with breast cancers, as well as normals and so on. So with this big data, it doesn't really make a difference because our scientists can work on the data from home, and we're working in full force from home for this type of work. But in the third part of work is where we have clinical trials. So for our clinical trials, we have two trials which are open. One is an intervention trial where we're bringing immunotherapy for a subset of Asian breast cancers. And this is now delayed by a few more months as a consequence of COVID. And in addition, our prevention trial is also starting to halt because we cannot bring patients into the prevention trial. In our fourth area, we're starting to do genetic counseling as well as patient navigation. And for those, we've tried to move as quickly as possible into telemedicine and telehealth. And in the large part, this seems to be working well, at least for the patients who we already know about and are already in our database. But it's very challenging to bring new patients into that initiative.
Going back to the lab work, because everything there has stopped and your lab has basically had to close, can you give us some insight into what would usually be happening in the labs for your research?
Well, different types. We're not the only lab that would close. So we have many collaborators in the University of Cambridge, for example, or the Wellcome Trust Institute. And those institutes have already announced that they're going to be closed until July. So it's a highly unusual circumstances the world over in terms of how we're dealing, how academic institutes, non-profit research institutes like ourselves are dealing with COVID-19 at the moment. So the type of research that we do is, for example, we grow cancer cell lines in a dish and we go in and use gene editing technologies to find essential genes. And then with those essential genes, that means the genes that keep cancer cells alive, we've been doing a lot of screens to find drugs that hit those cancer genes. So if a drug can hit those cancer genes and cause the cancer cells to die, then potentially that could be a new therapy for oral cancer. And that's what we've been working a lot on. But all of that has had to come to a grinding halt. So we've been making a lot of progress. We recently won the Newton Fund Impact Scheme Award, and we're the only Malaysians, I think, to have won this particular award. And unfortunately, the work cannot start because of this MCO. So we're doing all of the preparation work that we can on the background. But the reality is, even after MCO is lifted, there'll be a very slow start because our partners at the Wellcome Trust Institute in Cambridge also are not open. So I don't know yet what impact that would have. In addition to that, much of our work is in vaccine development. And for vaccine development, we've been in the final stages of testing our vaccine in terms of safety to be able to take this into clinic. And we had a large number of animal studies which had already been initiated, and some of these are now halted. And some of these are really expensive experiments because they are special strains of mice that are grown in a way to enable us to test specific types of immunotherapy. And it is priceless, the type of experiments that we're trying to do, but all of that is grinding to a halt at the moment.
And do you foresee that, or has your funding been affected in any way, whether grants are being pulled back, or perhaps if your trials are delayed, whether that will affect the funding that comes to you?
That's a really great question, Xiaoyik, but I think it's really too early to tell. You know, I wish I was at a crystal ball that would tell us what's going to happen, but over the past 6 weeks, that crystal ball has really absolutely failed. I think, you know what I mean, right? It's kind of like no one really knows what's going to happen next because it's really unprecedented times that we live in. You know, it's not just controlling in our own countries. We now have to control what happens at our borders, what happens in our neighboring countries, and so much of other people's actions could impact what happens in our world, right? We're not fully in control of what happens in our world. And Malaysia is hit by a triple whammy. You know, one, of course, is COVID-19. Second is the very, very low oil prices has a knock-on effect on the corporate world, particularly the Malaysian corporate world, that in turn has a very big knock-on effect on our donations. And thirdly, a very uncertain political climate. that could change the policies in terms of what happens for research funding. So it's really too hard to tell. And what's really sad from my perspective is it's a huge shame because we're at our most productive at the moment. We have a paper that's under review in New England Journal of Medicine that will report on the genetics of Asian breast cancers. We've been building a genomic map of Asian breast cancers. We have a new trial opening on immunotherapy in Asian breast cancers. We've got genetic counseling and patient navigation, and so much is happening and at the crux of where we are already making impact and poised to grow. So to have our funding cut at this point, it's really heartbreaking because we have so much that we can achieve with the right sustained funding, but we fully understand that it's very tough circumstances at the moment. People are struggling to put food on the table, and you know the economy is very uncertain. So our heart goes out to the community out there, and we're doing all that we can to try and make sure that you know we salvage and maintain all of our research programs at an international level as best as we can.
We'll go for a quick break now. I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia. I'm asking her, how is cancer research in Malaysia, particularly with CRM, being affected by the COVID-19 pandemic? But when we come back, we'll look at what does this mean to people living with cancer? And what does this mean for cancer care and treatment overall in times to come? So do stay tuned to us, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. On the line with me is Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia. We're talking about whether COVID-19 has disrupted cancer research. And the answer, unfortunately, is a resounding yes. And Professor Teo has been telling us about how Cancer Research Malaysia in particular, their work has been affected in several of the projects that they are working on. Professor Teo, I think ultimately the question, of course, is how will all these delays affect cancer patients?
I think in the short term, it's really about making sure that patients who've already been diagnosed can continue their treatment. So, for example, getting their medications, I think there's been some delay in terms of some difficulty for patients coming forward for treatment. But in the main, it's been okay because at the roadblocks and so on, people have been able to get their letters, flash their letters and get their treatments. So from that point of view, the patients who've already in the system, if you like, there's some delays, but it doesn't look too bad. I think the danger is that for these patients, obviously they are at higher risk because they have immune compromise. Their immune system is compromised either as a consequence of having cancer or as a consequence of the treatment related to cancer. And it's really important that we think about how we might be able to protect them while ensuring that we don't shorten their life by stopping their cancer treatment. So it's very important that that goes on as normal. I think a really big black hole that we're not yet dealing with because all of our services are shifted towards COVID is what happens with the patients that are not yet diagnosed. So people who have symptoms, for example, or people who may not yet have symptoms but have a cancer that's growing in them. Currently, the radiology departments are fully utilized by COVID, which basically means that we are finding it harder to bring forward imaging and diagnosis, especially in the Ministry of Health hospitals. And this is going to have a knock-on effect on delays to diagnosis and a knock-on effect on survival, because as we know, there is a dramatic impact on survival with late stage of presentation. The second area of concern is not just in radiology and imaging, but also in access to surgery. Because obviously surgery poses a risk for infection. When you put someone under the knife, you're putting them under general anesthetic, and obviously during the intubation process, there's a higher risk of infection. So a lot of the surgeries have been delayed, and delayed in cancer surgery, as well as delay in radiation therapy, could severely affect cure rates. So I think more immediately is we are already aware that there may be a knock-on effect on survival for existing patients. But in the longer or in the midterm, we need to really work out what is the knock-on effect for patients who are not yet diagnosed. And what would that be? What would that look like? You know, how many people are going to suffer unnecessarily because of such delays?
You know, this is going to be a difficult question, Professor Teo, but are we sort of missing the forest for the trees a little bit? Perhaps Like you said, these effects are severe. They are, the repercussions are going to be very, very long lasting. I don't want to downplay the risk of COVID as well. But the fact that so much of resources are being diverted and cancer doesn't stop, you know, the non-communicable diseases don't stop, other diseases don't stop. How do we balance that?
Wow, you ask very tough questions. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a $1 million question, right? So, or maybe even more. I mean, the reality is we don't know how much risk, you know, and those are affecting decisions in a myriad of ways. So, for example, you know, if you just scale back and look at and ask ourselves, what should we be doing? Should we be testing all patients for COVID before we give them chemotherapy and give them cancer treatment? Should we test everybody all the time and put our entire lives on hold for COVID because of the chance of infection as well as the 1% lethality that's associated with COVID at the moment, average? Should we be doing that? Potentially, if you are very risk averse, that may be the way forward. But cancer could kill you faster than, and the chance of dying of cancer if you already have the disease could be higher. So that basically means you have to still be able to balance the two status, right? And I don't think anyone has any practical view or recommendation for the time being. There's no data out there that can say what the right solution is at the moment. We're trying to do some research to try and measure the impact of COVID on timeliness of presentation, diagnosis, as well as treatment. In our patient navigation centers, we're looking at some data, and together with the Ministry of Health, we're also looking at other data. But this is uncharted territory for everyone. We're really trying to figure out what's the best way forward. And I don't think it's a case where we will go from point A to point B in a straight line. It's very likely that we'll take some twists and turns and really figure out what is the best way forward, because it's simply uncharted territories.
But coming back then to research specifically, how will all the delays in research then affect cancer patients? And of course, we can't see any immediate impact, but what's the knock-on effect?
It takes a really long time to get trials, to get treatments approved, you know. So for some clinical trials that are ongoing, if they fail to recruit, it might mean that a drug which could have taken 3 years for approval might take double that time for approval, because that trial, once it fails to accrue, or once it fails to what we call meet its endpoint, which is to show an effect of a drug, we will never get it past the regulators. The trial has to start all over again. So failure to recruit to a trial means that we don't have any data to say whether that therapy is better than the existing therapy. And if we cannot report on the trial because we haven't been able to bring patients in for the radiology imaging to tell whether the treatment works or not, and there are delays in the system, the trial will also fail. A knock-on effect would basically means that the time that it takes for a treatment to be approved and then delivered to a cancer patient is going to be much longer. So we don't know yet what that effect is going to be, but I anticipate that it will be far-reaching in terms of the impact of drug development.
And, you know, some patients may be on trials for potentially life-saving drugs. I think they're called treatment trials. So, and their cancer would be affected if the trial is stopped at this point. What is the ethical decision to be made for these kinds of trials?
I think in the main, for patients who are already in trials, the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which is the regulator in the U.S. for approval of trials and drugs and so on, have come up with various recommendations on how to deal with this. And some measures will include, for example, reducing the imaging frequency, trying to do things by telephone so that you have some of the measures that you want to measure whether the drug is having an effect or not done remotely, and so on and so forth. So we are doing, I think as a research community, we're doing all that we can that is practically possible to salvage trials and ensure that they don't fail. Because no one wants the drug development to slow down, and no one wants the drug development costs to go up, because the cost of drug development going up means that the cost of drugs in the future is going to go up further. So we have, I think it's part of our interest and our psyche, if you like, to really make sure that we can, as a community, that means the regulators, the researchers, the pharmaceutical industry, and the patients, as a community, we need to do all that we can to make sure that cancer research continues and that clinical research continues. And I would say that, you know, I'm optimistic. I think, you know, I'm generally try hard to be very optimistic, but I'm optimistic. I mean, so in the past 6 weeks, everyone knows what a vaccine is. Everyone knows what the immune system, and some people even know what a cytokine storm is. Most people know what a testing is, and even some knows what the RT-PCR is. And people now know that it takes time to do clinical trials to develop a vaccine and have it validated. So I think we are, strangely enough, in a time when a lot of people in the community are slightly aware, coming to be aware of the need for doing more research, the need to have scientists, the need to have tests, the need to have all of these things. We have more acute understanding that these things require investment if we're going to be able to fight diseases effectively. I'm hoping that, you know, that will translate not just to a better ability to deal with COVID-19, but a better sensitivity and awareness among all of us that we need. It's a collective responsibility to do more medical research to find cures for diseases.
But, you know, if we are looking ahead to that transition that you mentioned earlier, to a point when perhaps research can pick up where it left off, or perhaps, well, some of it may have to start from scratch again, but what kind of timeline should we expect? And, you know, is anybody having those conversations now about that transition?
Not yet, because I don't think we're out of the woods for COVID-19. So the reality is this COVID-19, I think we're only in the first phase of COVID-19. I think there may be future MCOs as a consequence of, you know, next rounds of infections, and we don't know yet where those are going to come from and how we're going to control them. So I don't think this is something that we have, we can talk about when we're going to start to go back to normal for other aspects of clinical research, including cancer research, maybe until we have a vaccine, potentially, you know, because until we have a vaccine, we effectively are living in cycles of MCO, non-MCO, MCO, partial MCO, and so on. And I don't think that cancer research is going to be considered critical enough as an investment until we have that point, which is a real shame because, you know, as I said in the beginning, immunotherapy, precision medicine are all poised to really make an impact on cancer survival. You know, it took us 40 years to have improvement in survival from 1 in 4 cancer patients to 2 in 4 cancer patients. So 1 in 4 cancer patients surviving 5 years in 1970 to 1 in 2 surviving 5 years in 2010. I had hoped that we would get to the next, next installment, 3 in 4, before 40 years. But who knows what is the impact of COVID? Maybe that would delay the advances in cancer research as a consequence of all of the knock-on effects of this pandemic.
And even if research is allowed to resume in the foreseeable future, what are the precautions that need to be taken to protect patients and researchers?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in the main, we mustn't forget that actually adequate protection with personal protective equipment, the PPEs, actually does significantly reduce risk of infection. So there's no real threat in a sense of, you know, kind of risking individuals' lives once there's sufficient PPE supplies in place and once there's sufficient testing and contact tracing, which Malaysia is doing pretty well with at the moment, thanks to the efforts of our brilliant DG and his team at the Ministry of Health. So I think I have confidence that with the right protection, we actually can go back to resume our efforts in clinical research beyond cancer, as well as cancer research, you know, as soon as we possibly can. But it's the other aspects that we cannot deal with yet. So, for example, you know, from a rational point of view, PPEs may be sufficient. From a from a patient's point of view, that is a decision that they need to make. And patients, I don't know yet how they feel towards research. We haven't got enough data yet on whether patient-related fears beyond what healthcare workers can reasonably anticipate is something that they would want to live with. Remember, cancer research, like any other clinical research, ultimately is a partnership between the doctors, the pharma companies, the researchers, and the patients. If we, doctors, hospitals, and researchers are ready, but patients don't feel that it is safe, we still can't move forward. So it's that constellation of so many factors that we need to bring together. It's a balance that is very difficult to ensure is optimum. It will take us some time to get back to normal. And I don't think it'll be the normal of the past. It has to be a new normal. So maybe some of the things that we insist on as part of clinical trials will need to be relaxed or modified. Maybe this is the right time for us to be thinking about telemedicine and remote reporting. How do we do this better? I think there are opportunities here to really revamp how we do things to improve efficiency in the new normal.
And that will include things like those large-scale conferences and meetings that are usually held as a platform to share research, isn't it? I mean, that's going to have to be reviewed as well.
Yeah, so I gave a talk online. So I was due to speak at a major cancer genetics meeting in Chicago, and I was not able to go, obviously, because of COVID-19. So I spoke at 11 o'clock at night while they were there about, I don't know, 10 o'clock in the evening or 10 o'clock in the morning or something. And whilst giving the talk and answering the question was kind of fun, you know, to be able to do this in a different platform and to be able to answer questions and interact individually in a different way, I think it misses out in many things. The reason why these meetings take place is because humans are a social animal, right? And what we do very well is we meet people, we discuss over coffee. And that's where ideas germinate. So, and that's where new collaborations come about. And the reason why I attend all of these isn't just to give a talk and present my update, but actually to really catch up with people and co-create new ideas that wouldn't happen if we didn't meet together. And no matter how efficient Zoom and Skype and other things, Microsoft Teams and Google Hangouts and other things are, it really cannot replace that human interaction, that coffee, that lull, etc., you know, that enables such ideas to germinate. And hopefully we will get back to a time where that can happen, but that's really difficult to see when that might happen.
And so, you know, I guess in a more personal way, I suppose, because I know for researchers, for scientists who work in research, it's your life's passion, isn't it? And so having to stop everything suddenly and seeing targets being missed and all that, how is it affecting you and your team?
I think if there's one characteristic that you can use to describe all scientists, we're eternal optimists. We have to be, right? Because science sometimes and research sometimes is 99% perspiration and 1% success, if at all. And that's a pretty successful scientist. Because you're constantly trying things in the hope that what you do will make an impact. So as an eternal optimist, we are very focused on our end goal. Our end goal is to ensure that there's more research in Asians, that Asians are not left out in the fight against cancer. And so if we can't access our lab, we use the time to access data from public databases and mine that in a different way. Our genomics works carry on as normal. If we can't access patients because it's been affected, we're already on the telephones and are actively following up patients on our telephone and starting to test out different platforms. So in other words, I think for scientists, we've probably taken to the MCO better than many other industries would have done. Because a lot of my team are young, tech-savvy, energetic, very, very keen to innovate and make sure that we continue to make impact. So because we are of a mindset that science brings solutions for human problems, you know, this is not something new to us. We will try and find a solution. And I think that the challenge for us is to make sure that we can communicate this with the wider public, that we're still here. We haven't gone away. We're still here. We're still working. If you have a spare dollar, think about Cancer Research Malaysia and supporting research, because maybe, you know, this at this time, people are more aware that science is necessary to find solutions for human problems.
More so than ever now, isn't it?
Absolutely, more so than ever. We need more people to come into the scientific world. You know, it's not enough to me. I think it's been really nice to celebrate the fact that there's a Malaysian scientist working on a rapid test in Oxford. There's a Malaysian scientist here and there working on various solutions elsewhere. But we should also celebrate and make sure that we continue to build a community of scientists locally. Because that community of scientists locally will ensure that the focus on Asian diseases, the Asian genomics, the Asian solutions are there. Oh, no, of course, we're not finding something just for ourselves. No, but what I'm trying to say is if we don't try, you know, the majority of the research out there focuses on high-income countries and the European population, European descent, right, in North America and Europe. We have to make sure that we do this for the Asian population. So this is a great time to talk about science, to talk about growing new scientists and talk about developing vaccines and developing tests and developing that community so that we are actively supporting research.
And Professor Teo, do you have a final message for us today?
Well, I think the message is just to stay safe. You know, for everybody, COVID-19 is the main thing that is going to change our lives, has already changed our lives. So please, please, please stay safe. But while you stay safe, I think, you know, we have a lot that is out there for the frontliners in terms of the doctors, but also in terms of the people, the NGOs that are out there serving the community who don't have any food on the table. But beyond that, the message would be, you know, think about how we might be able to do more research, more scientific research in Malaysia. And, you know, support organizations like Cancer Research Malaysia and other organizations that are trying to do research so that we can do more for the Asian population.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia, about how COVID-19 and the movement control order has affected cancer research, not only here in Malaysia, but also worldwide. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.